listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today.
From her childhood in a Jewish family to a seven-year stint with the Jehovah's Witnesses to years attending evangelical churches, Suzanne Lakin never felt comfortable with the doctrine of the Trinity. She signed up to attend Phoenix Seminary, a conservative evangelical school, thinking they would help her finally get to the bottom of it. She was willing to agree to the idea, thinking, surely studying with scholars like Wayne Grudem, the prince of evangelical systematic theology, and others, would answer her questions and settle the issue for her once and for all. Amazingly, the opposite happened. This is her story. Here now is episode 552, Seminary Convinced Me the Trinity Was Wrong, with Suzanne Lakin. Welcome to Restitutio, everyone. I'm glad you're here with us today. My guest is Suzanne Lakin of California. She's an experienced author, copy editor, and writing coach. She has a bachelor's in English literary studies, and recently she completed her master's degree at Phoenix Seminary in biblical and theological studies. She's especially passionate about the Old Testament and Hebrew, and I'm excited to share her story with you. So welcome to Restitutio, Suzanne. So glad to have you today.
Hey, shalom. Happy to be here.
Shalom.
I thought I'd throw some Hebrew in there since you and I have both done a little bit of Hebrew study.
Why not? So let's start in the beginning. Tell us how you became a Christian.
Well, that was about 50 years ago. So I was raised Jewish atheist, which is pretty common. Some people think that's weird, but that's about how it is these days. The term is matzah ball Jew. That's what we call ourselves, which is basically you celebrate the high holy days and call it good. Although I was the first in my family that didn't go to temple and get bat mitzvahed and all that. But everybody in my family did, except for me and my brothers, which I regret today because I would have learned some Hebrew when I was younger. So I started kind of searching for the meaning of life when I was a teenager. And weirdly, I hooked into some hippie friends of mine who were really into the Bible, and they believe that the Bible told about spaceships that were going to come and take us away. It was the 70s, and you know, there was a lot of post-Vietnam War angst and other social unrest that were making everybody want to leave the planet, I guess. So that got us interested in the Bible, my boyfriend and I. In fact, my boyfriend read something about Jesus getting baptized or whatever, and he said, I better get baptized. We didn't know anything about the Bible. He walked down the street to some little community church and asked the pastor if he could get baptized, and they baptized him. It's like, I don't even think they asked him any questions other than the baptism questions. So it was kind of funny. But I did get contacted by Jehovah's Witnesses at one point. And then my boyfriend, my best friend, a whole bunch of us, many of us Jewish, became Jehovah's Witnesses. And we had just started Bible study with them. And it was 1974. And the big push in 1974 with Jehovah's Witnesses is that the end was going to come in 1975.
Oh,
because they did calculations. I don't know if you know about that. But so they were really big on 1975 because they did.
What an exciting time to join the Jehovah's Witnesses.
That's why they had a huge influx in 1974, because they said they figured out the years and how long it might have taken Adam to name the animals, and that had something to do with Jesus, you know, returning in his presence in 1914, and this generation will pass away. They have all kinds of weird like ways they compute all that stuff. And then when they get it wrong and all the dates go by, they just default to the one verse, I think it's in Proverbs, that says, the way of the righteous is like a light that keeps getting brighter and brighter. And that is the only scripture that proves, kind of goes along with progressive revelation, but it proves that if you get it wrong, the light wasn't bright enough yet. And you just didn't kind of read God right. So I have this thing about how churches do this too, how the whole church history thing, as you know, like there's this whole belief that, you know, in accommodation, that humans weren't ready to know the truth, you know, so the Hebrews were never really given the truth about the Trinity, and there's all this other stuff, and that the light would just get brighter and brighter, and God would progressively reveal the truth until Now we have it, or we got it in the Reformation or something. You know church history better than I do, but I was a Jehovah's Witness for 7 years. I was really active there. I became a pioneer. I married a guy who was in New York at their world headquarters. So I worked at the world headquarters for a couple years. And I was very unhappy and very depressed. And I just kept reading the Bible and having issues with a lot of their cultish doctrines and practices, especially the shunning and the whole blood thing. So I got out in 1981. And then I spent a couple years online doing not interventions, but sort of helping other Jehovah's Witnesses that were trying to get out or were dealing with having to stay in because their whole family was in or their husband and kids were in and they didn't want to lose them because their shunning policy is really severe and horrible. I know people who basically got kicked out of their families and never spoke to their parents or their kids ever again. And it's just terrible. And they base it on a few scriptures. So it's, you know, it's bad.
And then what happened after you left the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah. So after 7 years, it was kind of a choice. Do I want to commit suicide or should I just leave and let God destroy me in Armageddon? That was kind of like my choice because I was at my end, my wit's end.
Wait, so commit suicide or what about Armageddon?
That God's going to destroy me at Armageddon if I leave Jehovah's Witnesses.
So you left thinking they're still right.
Well, I left not knowing if it was right or wrong. All I knew is that I couldn't stay in. So I just said to God, okay, God, if this is really who you are, and if this, are you really going to destroy me because I leave Jehovah's Witnesses, then fine, do whatever you want to do. You're sovereign, you're God. And, you know, I felt very at peace finally, because I'm like, you're God, you're going to do what's right. And it doesn't matter what I think. You know, I always kind of went back to Abraham talking to God about Lot and Sodom. And Abraham looks at God and says, well, isn't the God of all the earth going to do what's right? I always felt, yeah, God is going to do what's right. If he feels like I deserve death or whatever, then fine. I could live with that. I just didn't want to stay with my husband. I just didn't want to keep being a Jehovah's Witness. I left in 81. I divorced my husband. He stayed in until he died in 1993. I was out of touch with him and all the witnesses, of course, because I was shunned. So even my best friends, everybody that I knew, everyone I was close to, I lost. My family was happy, though, because they didn't want me to be a Jehovah's Witness. And then, you know, 20 years later, I became a Christian again, and they didn't like that either. So I can't win, whatever I do. So I basically left God. I never touched the Bible for 20 years. I married Lee, and we got married in 1983, had a couple kids. And then 2004... you know, our lives just came crashing down and my husband actually moved away from where we were living and moved in with some friends of ours in Paradise, California, before it burned down. They were very avid believers and churchgoers and they basically walked my husband through the Bible and he decided to give his life to Christ and get baptized. At that point, I kind of thought, all right, God, I'm going to give you another chance. I got all the Jehovah's Witness theology over here and the New World Translation. And then I got all this evangelical stuff over here. Half of this stuff I don't believe, half of that stuff I don't believe. I'm just going to dig into the Bible and really study it, get into the interlinear and the Greek and the Hebrew. Not that I studied the languages, but just at least looked up the words and compared translations and try to just push out all the doctrinal influence and see what I could just. I wish I had your 14 or 16 part podcast. Podcasts back then, how to read the Bible myself.
There you go.
But a lot of what you taught, I learned in seminary. So yeah, so that segues me. While he was a baby Christian and he's looking to me to tell him everything that's in the Bible, I sure formed his theology as we went along because I knew the Bible pretty well. I mean, I used to teach it a few times a week. I was in this full-time ministry, you know, so I still, even 20 years later,
I still remembered it, huh?
Oh yeah, it's like riding a bike. And, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, at least back when I was one, they were, you know, you had 5 meetings a week and you had ministry school. You read, you studied the Bible really intensely. And for that, I'm grateful. My 7 years as a witness was really, really helpful because it taught me to question everything. It taught me to check everything in the Bible. Of course, I did that with Jehovah's Witness teachings and that made me leave. But I never could accept like just going to a church and having somebody tell me what I'm supposed to believe. It's like, no, I'm going to check this out, which is why I ended up going to seminary right after I finished my bachelor's degree in 2021. Finally, because of COVID, I was able to do my last year online through Humboldt State University in California and finish the stupid degree that I started like 20, 30 years earlier, and I never finished because I started a business and have kids and life got in the way.
After your husband became a Christian, you said, I'm going to give this another chance. Did you guys go to a church out there?
Yeah, we went to a CMA, which is Christian Missionary Alliance. I've heard of those. Yeah, we went to a really good church. I mean, it's super Trinitarian. And even that just like bugged me from right at the beginning, because I would have all this problem where they'd be praying to God and then they'd say, yeah, and we're praying in your name and amen. And I'm like, wait a minute, who are you talking to? Jesus Christ. You know, it would just mess me up. So I never was able to get the Trinity thing. I mean, it just never was taught. It never made any sense to me. And I honestly believe that anyone picking up the Bible and just reading through the Bible, they're never going to find it in there. And hearing it just sounds so goofy, or my husband calls it goofballish. That's an adjective he's made up. So I actually returned to God, returned to faith. I didn't have any doubt about God being sovereign or the Bible being his inspired word. I just wanted to sift through the doctrines and get as clear as I could, because I was just tired of all the muddling. So yeah, I did a lot of just personal study on my own. We'd read a lot of books and, you know, read the Bible for ourselves.
So then about 15 years after that is when you went back to seminary. Do I have that timeline right?
Yeah. So Lee became a Christian in like 2004. And then we just, you know, we attended churches. We had a great church in San Jose where we moved to in California, Black church. And you know, we talk about this, our pastor there that we had for 13 years, never once mentioned the Trinity, the deity of Christ, homoousios, God-man. I mean, any of that stuff. He just never, I don't even, you know, if I asked him today, I wonder what he would say. Like, do you believe the Trinity? I don't know what he'd say. I just feel like he just avoided it completely and focused on how do we live like Christ. And I mean, everything he taught was beautiful and wonderful. And it was all about practical application and, you know, understanding the heart of God, the heart of Jesus. So it was great. Like, we didn't have any issues. It was so nice and refreshing to not have an American flag on the stage. Like, we hate the mixing of the politics and stuff. So that was our church for like 13, 14 years. And then COVID hit and we moved up here to Grass Valley, started going to another little local church here. But we just, you know, Anyway, so yeah, I went into seminary directly out of finishing up my bachelor's degree. I mean, immediately. I mean, I applied like the week I finished so I could send my transcripts.
It was almost like you got into this gear of college and you just kept going, all right, let's do the next one.
Yeah, actually, the main reason I wanted to complete my bachelor's degree, and I did it in English Literary Studies because I was almost done. I mean, I'd already done all the requirements. And, you know, the school I went to didn't really have much of a religious studies degree. That was my objective, finish school so I could go to seminary, because I've got to resolve this Trinity thing. I mean, that was the thing that was really bothering me. I just couldn't believe that 99.99% of all the Christians in the world believed that God was a triune God. And like, I call it the Elijah in the cave complex. Lee and I joke about this a lot, but we felt like we're the only ones. Like, I never heard the term biblical Unitarian or UCA or any of this stuff. I just figured I'm probably a wackadoodle that to believe what I believe, but whatever, God'll just deal with me in the kingdom and he'll set me straight. Like he's going to do with billions of other people when they're resurrected in the kingdom, they're all going to go, huh, I thought I was going to be in heaven. Wait, this looks a lot like earth. What the heck am I doing here?
It's funny though, when people really talk about heaven, you ask them about it, they describe a paradise on earth where there's like trees and grass, right? It's so funny.
Yeah.
Tell me about seminary then. Why Phoenix Seminary and what did you want to study there?
Oh, yeah. So I researched a lot of online seminaries. I definitely wanted to be online because I wasn't going to move or relocate. And I wasn't really near any big famous seminaries. Cost was an issue. And because of my GPA, Phoenix Seminary offered a 50% scholarship. So that saved me a lot of money. My main requirement was Hebrew, that my program had to require biblical languages. And I could have taken Greek too, but then I would have been so confused, because I can barely handle English very well. So, and I'm a really slow language learner. So I've been studying Hebrew for like, I don't know, at least 3 years. I started studying it way before I started seminary, just kind of learning the alphabet and trying to learn some of the stuff to get me ready. Nothing prepared me for a year of really heavy biblical studies. I love, love, love Hebrew. I'm just really slow at it. But I'm at the point now where I can pick up the Bible and I can read it, even if I'm not quite sure which verb conjugation it is, which stem it is. I can almost always figure out what's being said. Yeah. So there's always just a couple weird words here and there that are only in the Bible a few times. And you're like, what is that word? Okay. So look it up. But it's really super fun, as you probably know, because you just finished doing some studies of Hebrew. It's just a goofy language. And I say that if you don't know Hebrew, your listeners don't know some Hebrew, it's a funny language, because you can just move words around like a Tetris puzzle. And then you don't have any to be verbs. Like, there's no is or are in Hebrew. You know, you say ha'ish ha'tov, the man, the good. That means the good man, right? You would know that, right? It's like the construction is kind of wonkers, but I really enjoy it. That was my requirement, was to get into a school that I could study Hebrew. And I went through the whole gamut. You know, I had to do all the theology surveys. I had to do the whole Bible, all the surveys, Old Testament, New Testament. I had to do all the topics like the soteriology, Christology, all the church history. And I just want to say, I'm so grateful for your church history course, because as I was going through my year of church history, every week when I would watch my video lectures from seminary, you know, starting from the very beginning all the way through till today, I listened to your podcast on the same topic in the same
oh,
week.
Oh, that's so funny. So what was that like?
Oh, it was so cool. So first I would listen to the seminary lectures, you know, like be on the Anabaptists or whatever, the Great Awakening, whatever it is. And then I would just go, man. And then I would listen to yours and go, oh yeah, okay, that makes so much sense. Because, you know, as you know, like the books and all the lectures are so venerating the church fathers. And I don't even like using the term church fathers, that just like sticks like in my craw. And that's what I told the head of the school when we got in the discussion about my degree. I said, look, I'm Jewish. I don't like the Catholic Church, and I never have. And I do not believe that God used the Catholic Church for the first 1,000 years to disseminate the truth. Because they're a bunch of corrupt, evil, awful people. And, you know, come on, by their fruit, like, what does the Bible say? So just lost me on the creeds. Yeah, so I just really appreciated your perspective. And of course, I've read lots of other things online, but, you know, I had to write papers for church history. And so my last paper for church history was entitled Martin Luther's Place in the History of Christian Antisemitism. And it was basically a diatribe against Martin Luther and his disgusting hatred of the Jews. But see, they venerate these guys. You know, you hear these people lecturing and they're like, oh, we love Calvin and we love Martin Luther, and they did such great things for the Reformation. I'm like, did you know that Calvin like had Michael Servetus helped have him burned at the stake for not believing in the Trinity? I mean, like, it just really bothered me. And a lot of the literature, the books I would read, were very much like that, like just adoring. They would say things like, well, they had their faults, but they did so much for the Reformation. You know, they were just such great people. It's like, no, they weren't great people. They were awful people. You know, and when Martin Luther, you know, nailed his theses to the church door, he wasn't trying to like rebel against the Catholic Church, right? He was trying to work within the Catholic Church and stay in it. Anyway.
Well, there's a lot there. And in my classes, we spent so much time on Luther and Calvin, maybe just a little bit on Zwingli. And I just remember like it was yesterday when the church history professor got to the Anabaptists, there was like nothing, like literally 1 minute. And so when I did my class, I was like, I'm going to do one lecture on Luther and Calvin, and that'll be that, and then I'll move on. And, you know, I don't have as harsh of a view as you do on Luther and Calvin, because there is still a lot of good, but I definitely don't want to say they just fine and saintly people. Like, they did really bad things. And, you know, I don't think Luther would have ever claimed to be saintly. He was a little more in touch with his earthiness. Yeah. Whereas like Calvin, I think, really would claim ultimate purity for all of his actions all of the time. So anyhow, what was it like learning all this stuff? Like, you're sifting through it. You're thinking, this is good. This is questionable. And you're making your way through.
One of my professors was a pretty strict Calvinist, and went through a lot of his systematic theology. He's pretty famous. It was interesting because...
Yeah, I know that professor. Is that the...
Yeah. Or Wayne Grudem. You know, the problem with the online program is you never really got to talk to your teachers. I was able to talk to Dr. Grudem very, very briefly, because he gave a special talk on Zoom that I attended, and they had a Q&A he's really like very classicist, you know, everything like God is impassible, God doesn't feel any emotions. You know, he's really big Calvinist and like the whole predestination thing and everything, you still have free will, but God's, it's already decided everything that you're going to do and everything that's done. And everybody who's going to be saved has already been chosen. And everybody who's going to be, you know, burn in hell has already been chosen. So like, what the heck, why should you do anything? I don't know. We have these interesting discussions. We do discussion boards and things, but I was able to ask him one question live on a Zoom. And it was pertaining the name of God being in the Hebrew scriptures for thousands of years and why the ESV committee, which he was on, decided to use the Lord in capital letters instead of going with the Tetragrammaton or Jehovah or Yahweh or something. And he just basically cut me off and treated me like I was just a stupid idiot. And yeah, I'm sorry. I was really kind of taken aback that he was so rude to me because he just interrupted me. And he just said, well, that's how the Septuagint, you know, uses it. It was because the Septuagint, and I'm thinking, well, let's see, the Septuagint had, you know, added 100 lines to the book of Esther. Like these 70 guys, if they were really 70, took a lot of license in changing the Bible to the way they wanted it. What about the Masoretic text? Why don't we go back to the Hebrew? Why don't we go back to the fact that the Tetragrammaton is in the Old Testament? It's like 7,000 times, not counting Yah. In like hallelujah, like, you know, and I wanted to discuss that very politely with him, but he just wouldn't have it. He's like, nah. That kind of annoyed me a bit.
Let me pause you there. I want to make a comment on what you just said about the name of God. So The Septuagint is the Greek translation from maybe around 200 years before Christ. You know, it's kind of speculative. Regardless, no Protestant Christians use the Septuagint as their like the ESV did not use the Septuagint as the Bible they translated into English. So like by their own usage of the Masoretic text, the ESV committee is admitting that the Hebrew is better than the Greek, and therefore we should translate from the Hebrew. But then they chose the Greek way of saying the name of God over the Hebrew. It's an inconsistency. You're absolutely right.
Well, you know, it's the Trinitarian bent too, because the more that you can muddle the identity of the Lord, I think you mentioned it in one of your podcasts. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that, for instance, like when Paul quoted from the Old Testament, the only times that he would refer to the Lord as Yahweh would be those quotes from the Old Testament referring to Yahweh. That the New Testament writers, when they would speak about the Lord, they were speaking of their master, Jesus Christ, but they always referred to God. God was always the Father. God is always Yahweh or whatever. Maybe they didn't put that name in there specifically, but to them, there's one God, the Father, right? So I think there's a deliberate decision for a lot of these translation committees. I've listened to so many podcast episodes on translations and some of them on your show, you know, going back to talking with Jerry Werewolf and different people. One of the books that I really loved that I read in seminary was Leland Ryken's book, The Word of God in English. And he's got a lot of books. I actually emailed him and I asked him this question. He was very nice and wrote back. We discussed a bit about why the name Yahweh or Jehovah is not in our Bibles, you know, in all translations, like why people aren't acknowledging it.
What did he say?
He just said I asked him about the ESV committee and he said he really didn't know. I asked him like, why didn't this committee want to use that name or why aren't people using that in translation? So he was kind of vague about it. He said he didn't feel like it was really that important an issue. I'm not sure what his, I don't know. I think he's a Christian. I mean, I don't know. He's got a lot of books out. Maybe he's more of a philosopher or a linguist. He's more into linguistics. But that's a great book. If people want to get it, Leland Ryken's book, The Word of God in English. It really was great. And I shared it with my husband because it's all about all the different common translations, what their problems are. He compares like passages across a number of translations. So you can see the biases, you know, like I said, because of having been a Jehovah's Witness and having the New World Translation, which I think in a lot of ways is a great translation in many instances, because I have compared so many Bibles over the last 20 years. And some of those verses, I think, are pretty good. I think Ray Franz had a pretty good handle on some of the word choice. But I think, you have to really compare a lot of translations and be really careful with these dynamic equivalent versions because they put in a lot of their biases and their doctrinal stuff. So that was my take, was that the Lord, if you just change God's name to the Lord, in the New Testament, then yeah, of course, Yahweh is Jesus. I mean, there's the Lord, even if it says there's only one Lord Jesus and there's one God, the Father, it just kind of, I don't know, they blip over that verse in John. I don't know.
So you think it's doctrinal bias or maybe a fear of doctrinal clarity that's driving that?
Yeah.
What else were you about to say? You said seminary was really good for something.
Oh, yeah. So I got to study under John Mead. I don't know if you know John Mead.
Oh, that was one of my questions. I'm like, did you get to study under John Mead? Because I'm a big fan of his.
But John was amazing. I told him personally when I talked to him during one Zoom session, I said, taking your survey of the Old Testament, and, you know, he's big on the kingdom through covenant, you know, Gentry's thing.
Well, he recruited Gentry to come. He and Pete Gurry.
Yeah, and right. So I said, taking your Old Testament survey class was worth going to seminary and was worth paying the entire tuition so I could take your class. And he was like, oh, that's so nice. And I also have his newest book that he did, Scribes and something. I haven't read it yet. But, you know, he's so brilliant. He knows the canon really well. It was really challenging to take the class because we had to go through canon lists and compare and write papers. And then he made us like go through all these Hittite treaties and compare that with the Deuteronomy, you know, the Sinai covenant. I mean, it was heavy. That was like my first semester. I'm like, whoa, this is intense. So I loved his class and that was super great. I also studied with Dr. Thigpen, Michael Thigpen, who is an amazing Old Testament scholar, and his expertise is in Jeremiah is his main book, but he also is really knowledgeable Isaiah, Ezekiel, you know, the major prophets. So I took his survey class for the prophetic books and wisdom literature. And I also took he had a special Jeremiah elective, and that was great. I mean, I had to write a lot of papers, but I really learned so much about the book of Jeremiah. And so it was totally worth all of that. My Hebrew teacher was fantastic. A year of biblical Hebrew was just like, they cram like 5 years of Hebrew into 1 year. And then every week you're doing, I don't know what they call it. You know, you take a passage, you know, he would just have us do a different passage from Genesis. And we had to break down every single word. What is it? What does it mean? Parse it out with what stem it is and all the different nuances to the language. Just massive amounts of Hebrew homework, but it was really super fun. But I'm done. It's like, people are like, well, why don't you, you know, they said they'll transfer my credits to another school. Like, why don't I go to another school and get a degree using those credits? And I'm like, I'm exhausted. I finished my undergraduate, went right into seminary, finished all that. Yeah. So I think if I ever were to continue, I'm fascinated by more the psychology of religion. And I think when I was listening to Stephen Nemish, and I think it was on your podcast, you're talking about why people are so afraid to face certain doctrines, like to look at the Trinity. I have a case in point. I have a friend who I've been very, very close friends with, like one of my best friends for years. And a couple of months ago, you know, she was just going through a lot. Her mom's dying and she's an evangelical. She's really big on everything, you know, the main ones, Trinity, hellfire, blah, 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 going to heaven when you die, all that stuff. And we would never really have much discussion about the Bible, you know, except for things we had in common. I don't even think she knows that I'm a Unitarian by faith, but I was talking to her on the phone and trying to encourage her. And I was trying to think of a way to like kind of share the gospel with her to try to encourage her because her mom's dying and her mom is not a believer. And she really, really, really believes her mom is going to burn in hellfire for the rest of her life. And I just happened to have written a whole book on hell, you know, that's published with the same publisher you have. So that's a topic that I've researched on and off for 40 years, that it's something that I'm very passionate about, meaning that the scriptures do not teach that God is that kind of an awful God that would do those types of things to people. So I was trying to encourage her and she got really defensive and really mad and really emotional. And I think it shattered our friendship. And now we kind of are politely talk every once in a while. But she was like, you think you're so smart. You went to seminary. I read the Bible every year and I know what it says. I know the Bible teaches hellfire. I know my mom's going to burn in hell. And I'm thinking, God, how do I reach her? Like, how do I help her drop her defenses so that she can hear, like, you know, I just think of that verse that Jesus quoting from Isaiah, whatever, about these people, they hear, but they don't hear. They close up their ears. They close their eyes. I can't heal them because they have built this wall. And that's what I see. And I have been talking to a lot of Unitarian Christians and people like in leadership positions in UCA, and I'm like, we really need a training program that teaches psychology. I don't remember if it was you, but there's been some podcast episodes lately just about how to deal with people's biases and how to, I mean, I think it was yours. Were you talking with Jerry or somebody? I don't remember, on how to get past the biases. Like when you're talking to somebody, how to build sort of a rapport, common ground, so that people don't shut these doors so they can't hear the truth about the kingdom and about God and about Christ.
Let's go back to seminary for a second. Would you say that going into seminary, you pretty much wanted to believe in the Trinity, and you figured people of the stature of the great Wayne Grudem, the prince of evangelical systematic theology, and others, that they would be able to disabuse you of any kind of questions or concerns you had regarding theological philosophical contradictions or biblical strained readings or whatever. Was that your mindset going in, or was it more like, I know this is wrong, I'm going to keep my head down, and I'm just not going to bring it up because I'm already convinced? What was your mindset going in?
It was the former, definitely. I mean, I had to sign a statement of faith, and I had to affirm their statement of faith, which is, they don't mention the Trinity, but they say God exists in three persons. And I'm like, okay, I'm willing to, like, let's go with that. I'm willing to agree at this point that that's a possibility. So I was good with that. I didn't go in with any kind of like, I'm gonna prove them wrong or anything. I definitely felt in my heart that it was gonna be a hard sell to get me to believe the Trinity, but I did feel like if anybody could convince me, they could, and seminary would. And so that was one of my main reasons for going. The other main reason was I just wanted to like have an excuse to be having to study the Bible 12 hours a day, you know, and after I learn how to write papers. And, you know, I just really wanted to just dive in, you know, and have that immersion into the Bible.
And what happened as far as your beliefs go on who Jesus is?
Everything that I studied and all the systematic theology books and all the materials and articles and everything that I read, I just kept coming back around to what I had always believed and seen in the Bible, you know, that it just, there's nothing in the Bible that teaches the deity of Christ, or that God is a tripersonal God, or that there's, you know, Jesus is a God man, there's incarnation, and, you know, all these things, I mean, that I already had studied pretty heavily on my own. I just kept waiting for some light to come on, like for me to go, oh, I get it now. The Bible really is a secret code book, you know, and only the elite that have some special gift from God can really understand it. You know, that, so it just, you know, it kind of harkened back to the whole Gnostic. I felt like it was like Gnosticism 2.0 or something, where like only like really special people can get it. So you have to just trust the theologians and the pastors and all those people who say, oh yeah, the Bible, God is a Trinity. You know, the common person can't find that in the Bible, but just trust the church fathers. They, you know, they had, you know, I don't know, they had an extra portion of Holy Spirit or some kind of thing like that. Yeah. So that was, yeah, that's where I landed.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you got exposed in the aftermath. I know you also have shared this on a different podcast, but maybe just in a brief way, you could just go through that.
By the time I got to the end of my last semester, and I saved church history for last, because I knew this was going to happen. I just knew it. I went through everything. And then I think my last two classes were church history 1 and 2. So a year study all the way through church history. I'm like, yep, yep, yep. All this stuff is just made up. And it's just, you know, it was kind of like the icing on the cake. So by the time I got to my last semester, all these papers I started writing, I had to write a paper on Calvin's Institutes. And I started pulling in all these things that he wrote in his book, that just a gobbledygook about Jesus's essence and how sometimes he knew he was God and other times he didn't. And, you know, the essence, I mean, it was like he was throwing these terms around, all the Greek terms, the homoousios and all the stuff. And the, you know, and I'm just like pointing out in my paper, this is ridiculous. This doesn't make any sense. This is illogical. There's no scriptural basis for this, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, my professor somehow got a hold of my paper, probably because the PhD student that was like monitoring the class, red flags went off in his head, and he gave it to my history professor, who happened to be the provost and the, you know, interim president of the school now that Brian Arnold left. he emailed me and just said, what is your stance here? I read your Calvin Institutes. It seems to me that you don't believe in the deity of Christ. And that started some emails back and forth. And when I was very straightforward, I, you know, people said to me, why don't you just lie? I'm like, wait, excuse me?
Because you're a Christian.
Yeah, because I'm a Christian. Like, I'm not going to lie. And also, I saw this as an opportunity that God could use for me to witness or make a testimony to some very big higher up people in evangelical Christianity today. And you know, so I just started in my emails, I started going into my whole list. You know, I even think I used the Sean Finnegan 5 points of how you know the Holy Spirit's not a person. Like, he doesn't have a name, you know, nobody prays to him. You know, I did the whole thing. Right. Yeah. So see, I learned a lot from you, Sean.
Well, that wasn't original from me either. I learned that from someone else. So
yeah. So we all encourage one another with stuff. He only wrote me back a couple times until he finally realized, like, oh, you are a heretic. And then he stopped communicating with me altogether and hid behind the student advisor, and she wrote me a couple times and said, well, we're not going to let you graduate because obviously you don't believe in the Trinity any longer. And because he said, well, do you believe in the deity of Christ? And I said, well, I do, but not in the way you probably mean it. Would you like me to explain? You know, crickets. So, so I did recently get a final letter from the student advisor saying all the higher ups had a discussion about my situation and they all agreed not to let me graduate. And the reason for that is that, well, this is the way we've always done it. And we just didn't feel like we should try to make any major changes, you know, in our policies. Because I said, like, if you're not going to let me graduate because I've changed my views, why aren't you researching all the students that have graduated in the last 40 years and just make sure that they haven't changed their views so you could rescind their degrees because they no longer faithfully represent Phoenix Seminary's belief system. It's not like I was getting an MDiv or getting confirmed to be a minister or something of a denomination. I did a Master of Arts. I went through a program to learn what the Bible taught, and I completed it with like a 3.9, you know, GPA, I feel like I earned my degree. So when he said, oh, we're just, you know, we feel we should just stay with what we've always done. And I wrote, it's good to know that people who really believe the Bible and wanted to please God back during the Reformation time didn't have that attitude, because otherwise we would have never had the Reformation. If they just said, oh, well, the Catholic Church is the way it's always been. We don't want to make any waves. We don't want to change our policies, even though they didn't admit that the policy was wrong. But he was kind of hinting at that, because to ask somebody to promise that they will never change their beliefs by the time they graduate, because you have to reaffirm your statement of faith when you graduate. I mean, I know people that take 10 years to get their degree because they're working full time. Some of them are pastors already. So like, what happens if 10 years down the line, you say to them, my beliefs have changed. How can they make you promise that you won't change your beliefs? I told them, I said, this is illogical and unreasonable. I mean, it's one thing when you start a program, say, yes, I agree with your statement of faith. But you can't say, I understand that I'm going to have to keep that same belief by the day, on the day I graduate.
So you spent thousands of dollars and multiple years of your life. And In the end, they just said, no, we're not going to give you a degree.
Yeah, because that's the way they've always done it.
That's unjust.
How was their excuse? Well, I'm still working with the Arizona State Board of Private Postsecondary Education, although it's hard to get them to do anything. But they are looking into it. There is case law that kind of can work on my side, not to get my degree, but to get at least a refund. I could be audited for less money if I wasn't planning on getting a degree. So yeah, so I'm kind of pushing on that. And I keep telling them, look, I really want to push them to at least give me partial refund. So far, it's kind of dragging along. But I'll keep at it. I'll see what happens, you know, in the latest saga. There's something like a 3-year statute of limitations. And I started this right away. So I have lots of time to keep pushing this. I got, you know, initially Brandon Duke was helping me try to find a lawyer to see if I could maybe do, you know, some kind of legal action. But, you know, the law is pretty much on the side of a private religious institution. Like, they can just say, you know, we want to just give degrees to people who believe what we believe. And they have the right to do that because it's not a public school that's publicly funded.
The take-home lesson is find out from the seminary ahead of time if you have to believe in the Trinity when you graduate. And you have advised others on this and saved others some serious pain and suffering. So that's the take home.
Yeah. So I'm happy about that, so others, but I do, and I did say this to this professor and I was pretty clear. I said, I kind of felt like saying, well, what would Jesus do? like that little saying, because I'm thinking if you're all about the Great Commission to make disciples, I mean, I get having a school where you want to train people to be pastors and missionaries and all that, to teach what you think is the truth from the Bible. I get that. But at the same time, why don't you let Muslims and atheists and Jews attend seminary? If your hope is that they will come to an accurate knowledge of the truth by being exposed to your teachings, then why aren't you being inclusive instead of exclusive? Crickets. I still didn't get any response back, but maybe that put some thoughts in their head that maybe things will change. I don't expect it.
Yeah, you can't underestimate the influence, even a hard question can have on somebody, even if in the moment it seems like you're talking to a brick wall. Right. God can use those things. I did have a question about Brian Arnold because he had been their church history guy. So you didn't get to take any classes with him?
No. Well, I did. I took my writing and research class, which was fantastic. I took hermeneutics from him.
He seemed like a really good teacher to me.
Oh,
I don't know.
He's great. And I did the graduate research and writing class was excellent. I wrote a good paper and I learned how to do that. His hermeneutics class was really good, although it was kind of weighted heavily on, veneration of the church fathers and their hermeneutical methods.
Well, he's big into church history.
Oh yeah, that's his thing. So I didn't take his church history classes. I took those from Dr. Hogg, David Hogg. But I really liked Brian Arnold. I mean, he was amusing. He kind of reminds me of you in a lot of ways. Just really entertaining.
I like him too.
Yeah. He's fun to listen to. And I learned a lot. I mean, the hermeneutics class was hard. I mean, our big paper that we had to write was on Romans 11. He said, I picked the hardest passage in the entire Bible for you to figure out what does it mean? What is the elect? So we had to do massive, word studies and bring in Atlas images. I mean, we just a huge amount of stuff to do the hermeneutical study on that. But I got some great skills. I know how to do word studies really well now so that I just feel very confident when I do my research, so that I kind of know I'm getting the best information that I can.
I want to back up a second in your story and ask you how you first came across other Unitarian Christians. Like you mentioned coming across this podcast, Restitutio. Were there others that you came across before that? How did you land connecting here? Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just really prayerful, getting into seminary and like I said, having the Elijah complex. I'm like, God, how can I be the only person that feels this way? And I discovered an excerpt from Kermit Zarley's book, The Restitution of Christ, which was out of print. And I think I hounded him for 6 months saying, will you please get this book out?
He did
because of me, I think. And he sent it to me. I have a copy right over here. I was so impressed by the chapter that I read. I'm like, oh, this is what I believe. I knew from church history about Unitarianism and everything, but I didn't know that there was a biblical Unitarian presence in the world today, and that there's a lot of biblical Unitarians floating around. So from Kermit Zarley's book, I don't know how I somehow connected to, I found Eric Chang's book, The Only True God. And when I read that, I think there was a footnote or something in there that referenced the YouTube channel, The 21st Century Reformation. So I got onto that and started watching some videos of Anthony Buzzard. But then that is where my husband and I discovered your 20,000 part course. Well, you had two of them, right? You had the church history one. But the first one we went through that was really helpful for my husband especially was the God, the One True God.
One God overall.
Yeah, so we watched every single one of those. And then we learned, hey, Sean Finnegan has a podcast. And then so from there, we, all the different people you had on your podcast, I'm like, huh, there's Bill Schlegel, and he's got One God Report. And then there's Dale Tuggy, and he's got Trinity's podcast. And
right,
then there's,
yeah, you start to see more and more of the community.
And then there's the UCA, and we joined that, and we're like, oh, this is really cool.
And that's where you met John Truett and the Allegiance to the King at the UCA, or?
through you, I think you might have recommended
through
it.
Me.
We
okay.
were an online fellowship, and I think somebody recommended, I thought it was you maybe that might have directed us that way.
Okay. Yeah, you were asking about online fellowship. I probably did recommend them. We'll talk about Allegiance to the King and how you're connected with them now.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really want to put a plug in for Allegiance to the King. I love our online fellowship. You know, there's members in six continents. The thing I love about it is that we don't have a pastor. It's not like a church with one pastor. We have a number of members that were pastors for many decades. And it's just so encouraging because we have a whole bunch of people teaching for, and they are in all different countries, you know. So I teach once a month. I'll be teaching next Wednesday, I guess. So there's teaching on Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings, depending on where you are in the world. It might be a different day, different time, but it's really nice. Yeah. So we just meet on Zoom. And I just think it's absolutely fantastic.
And if somebody wanted to connect, what's the website?
Okay, so you can go to a2kchurch.org, and that's letter A and the number 2 and K. Yeah, a2kchurch.org. And then there's the Facebook group, Allegiance to the King. If you want to watch a lot of the, there's two YouTube channels. So there's the Allegiance to the King YouTube channel, which has a lot of the more lengthy sort of Bible studies. The Christian Virtual Fellowship is where, you know, what I teach through, and that's also a different YouTube channel. I think we're working toward combining it all into something more streamlined.
And what about Salt and Light? You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, so that's a nice group I think you connected me with, because that meets on Tuesday evenings, and mostly, and both these groups, we do prayer. We just catch up on how everybody's doing. It's really all about community in Christ. I'm trying to live like Christ in the world. It's not a place, a forum to like argue doctrine or push doctrine down people's throats. It's really, the emphasis is on living out the faith, you know? So I think it's just.
This must have been very encouraging to you to discover that there are living communities of Christian Unitarians, biblical Unitarians throughout the world, right? Must have really been, I think, a relief maybe for you.
Oh,
is that,
yeah,
how you would describe it?
Yeah, relief, but it's also really exciting. I just see God just doing stuff, you know, working and moving. And I, you know, I just like believe the way all of you guys do that are teaching biblical Unitarianism and trying to get the truth out, is just really believing that God is just going to grow this and have a 21st century Reformation. So, because so many people are so disillusioned, so many people who claim to be Christian don't really know much about the Bible or God, and they're not getting that help in their life to really, the word empowers you, the truth empowers you. God's Spirit empowers us to have authority and to live in this world with amazing, I don't even know how to begin talking about it. I mean, I just feel like so many people need God, need the truth, need fellowship, need community, and they're not getting it where they're at. So I'm just excited to see what God's doing. And it's interesting that when I started seminary and really digging into these questions, that God seemed to like pull us out of the churches that we were attending regionally. And we're like, where do we go? You know, we're stuck in this cave all by ourselves. And God's like, come here, I'll show you. There's a whole bunch of people over here. Just come over here. And got me out of the cave.
Very cool. If you were going to snap your fingers and change one thing about the Unitarian, biblical Unitarian community, what you've seen so far out there, what would it be?
I would just like to have more conferences in California.
Okay. Two East Coast centered, not enough,
yeah,
West Coast.
Yeah, just got back from Kentucky, so we had a big A2K gathering. It was really fantastic.
Let me ask you about being an author, since that's like such a big part of who you are, and you have your pen name, C.S. Lakin. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, as far as especially, well, let me ask you this first. What kinds of books have you done? Because I think you have a good range of different kinds of books, right?
I have about 30 books published. So about 20-something novels and 10 or at least 10 or more writing craft books. So I write nonfiction, but everything is pretty much focused on writing. I'm a writing coach and focus on fiction. So I have a lot of books on fiction craft. I have a lot of online courses on fiction writing. I teach at conferences. I was keynoting in Ireland last fall. I'm keynoting up in Anchorage, Alaska this October. But this is all on writing. Yeah, so the only non-fiction book that I have that's biblical based is my book Hell No, and I use my married name for that. Yeah, Hell No. S.L. Miller is my married name. So yeah, and I also have I have a 6-book historical Western novel series, and that's with a different pen name, Charlene Whitman. I've always loved writing. I come from a family of writers, and so I've been, writing and publishing novels for a lot of years, and I'm a book copy editor, so I've been editing. I probably have worked with maybe 6,000 writers.
You have kind of inherited, in a sense, this whole world from exposure from your parents and Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Hollywood with a screenwriter, producer, mother. My dad died when I was young, so she raised her 3 kids, broke into Hollywood as a screenwriter. She wrote over 430 scripts that were made into TV episodes. Like, she created some series The Rookies and Flamingo Road and all these different soaps and things like that. My brother also was a producer writer. He produced Dallas and Falcon Crest and a bunch of movies. My stepfather was a director producer, so he did a lot of TV movies. It was all television. They didn't do feature film. But so I was raised reading a lot of screenplays and sitting on sets and sneaking in. My mom would have offices in different TV studios, and I would sneak into sets and watch them film MASH or Lost in Space or something like that. So kind of fun. For a while, we lived in Beverly Hills.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And, so my life was kind of growing up in Hollywood. My mom was story editor on Mod Squad. She was the first female story editor in Hollywood. But I used to go when they would go on location, to the LA Zoo or something to shoot something. I would always sit on Peggy Lipton's chair when I was 10 years old. I'd wear dark sunglasses and I would pretend to be some kind of movie star or something, because I got to be everybody else had to stay outside the barricades, and I got to be I got to be in this, part of it.
If somebody's watching this or listening to it that has a book that they've written, you offer critiquing services, right? So maybe mention a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have a website called Live, Write, Thrive, and it's WRITE, Live, Write, Thrive. So you can find all my stuff on there, my coaching packages, mentor packages. Like I said, I work with thousands of writers. I help people all the time to write books. Actually, while I was out in Kentucky, I was chatting with one of the gals there who wants to be a writer, and she's at a writer's conference right now. And I helped her for a while, just, talked to her, gave her some tips and assignments, things to do with her writing. And she's going to send me some stuff, and I'm going to try to help her. I edited and proofread Kermit Sarley's last book on, I forgot what it's called. I gave him the title to the book.
It's called The Restitution of Jesus Christ.
Oh, no,
The Restitution.
Yeah, no, I didn't work on that book. I worked on his book, The Church, Gospel Corrupted.
The Gospel Corrupted, yes. I just interviewed Kermit on both of those books. And that interview will probably come out after this one. So this is a good advertisement to stay tuned.
I gave him his title. I said, look, the way nonfiction titles work is you always have one or two words, right? Isn't yours like 2 words, kingdom, journey? So you usually have one or two words for your title, and then you have a really long subtitle that explains what the book's about. I think his title was something like How the Church Corrupted the Gospel. I said, okay, that's a terrible title. You need something different. So it's like The Gospel Corrupted. Okay, that sounds like the Da Vinci Code. That works. And then he has the subtitle. So I edited that book, and then I just recently did some proofreading on Dustin Smith's book on wisdom Christology in the Book of Joshua. I mean, not like he needed a lot of editing, but it was just like some little technical proofreading kind of things. So yeah, that's the kind of stuff I do. And
yeah, so people can get in touch with you if they're interested in getting your services. You also have online courses that people can purchase to learn how to write better, which is important, to communicate well.
I know I've had at least 5,000 people take my courses, and some of them have taken all of my courses. Yeah, online courses, and it's fun. Yeah, so that's my big thing is writing and editing, and I'm not sure if I'm going to write any more theology books. If there's some topic that kind of gets under my skin, I'll probably maybe think about doing another book. But there's so many great books already written that I normally don't want to write a book unless I'm frustrated. And it's like Toni Morrison said, if there's a book you want to read and you can't find it, then you should write it. And that's probably why you wrote Kingdom Journey too. And I'm really excited that you want to put your How to Read the Bible for Yourself as a book, or maybe a workbook or something.
Yeah, it'd be a small group guide type book.
Yeah,
you can read and then have questions.
So needed. I mean, even around the world in a lot of different countries, they need that they need all that information. And everybody, wow, I'm excited about that book to come out for sure. Get on it.
Very good. Anything else that you'd like to bring up before we finish our conversation?
I really am grateful for you to have me on. And I encourage people who want to go to seminary or to get some sort of advanced degree or even just an education in the Bible. I think it's really, really helpful to go into the enemy camp. I hate to say it like that, because that's how I felt, especially the last couple of years. I felt like I was in the enemy camp, because in the discussion boards and stuff, I would sort of hint at like things or ask questions about these different doctrines, and people would be concerned. They'd say, I'm really concerned about your answer, Suzanne. I'm concerned about your immortal soul. I'm worried that you're going to burn in hell. You know, I'm like, well, thank you for your concern. I'm kind of concerned about you too. I'm not saying that, you know, that we need to send armies into enemy camp and try to like convert them or convince them they're wrong. I mean, if God leads you to do something like that, I felt very led by God to speak up and to state my truth and to speak up for the character of God and the person of Jesus. But that wasn't my intention going in, of course. But I just feel like, you know, you should do that. You should find a way. If you want to go to seminary, you want to get that education, you need to know that you're going to be taught a lot of stuff that you probably don't agree with. But I think it's really, really important, just like when you go to any other country and you learn their culture, you want to know, like, how do they think? How do they live? What do they believe? And then, you know, like Paul says, you have to be all things to all people. You can't really have discussions with evangelicals or Trinitarians if you don't really understand where they're coming from and why. And it's not just about proving one verse means something different than they think. I mean, it's really getting their mindset and understanding that if they've been indoctrinated, I mean, I consider evangelical Christianity a cult, because any religion or religious belief that makes you so fearful that you call someone a heretic and you're scared of them because they're trying to have a discussion with you about an intellectual topic, that should be a red flag, you know, in terms of cult behavior. So I just feel like it's important that we, you know, that we're aware of that. And I would just encourage people to just try to be open-minded and listen and just see where they're coming from. I have friends on my street that are Mormon, you know, super conspiracy theorists, evangelicals. You know, we talk about all kinds of stuff. I just try to avoid certain subjects because I just don't want to get into useless arguments, which was Paul warned against. I think he told Timothy. The objective is to love our neighbors and to find common ground. So that's really the thing that I'm aiming for. It's like, how can I love my neighbor? I can bring their trash can up. They might be a Trinitarian, but like, can't I just bring their trash can up and show them that I care about them? Like, come on, you know, we need to do that kind of stuff.
Very good. Well, Suzanne, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Sean. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Well, that brings this interview to a close. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org. It's like the word restitution with no N. And find episode 552, Seminary Convinced Me the Trinity Was Wrong, with Suzanne Lakin. And leave your comments, questions, and feedback there. Speaking of feedback, we've had a couple of people comment in on our last episode about helpful tools to study the Bible. And one of those was none other than Suzanne Lakin herself, who wrote the following. She said, I did hours of training on Logos software and I gave up. Completely beyond my ability to navigate, even with pages of notes. And Blue Letter Bible is my go-to for looking up verses, comparative translations, and interlinear. Though, of course, I'm always finding the Hebrew translation wonky in spots, but that's me. And then we had two other comments come in just on the Facebook post. Oh, by the way, if you're not in the Restitutio Facebook group and you're a Facebook user, why not join? And if you're a user on a different social media that allows groups, why not start a Restitutio group where you hang out online, just so that we can have engagement and share ideas? Someone named Ziad wrote in, what do you think of the Net Bible Notes and also Constable Notes? Kermit Zarley replied, I like Net Bible Notes, and Blue Letter Bible is my go-to also, but not because I'm following my editor, referring back to Suzanne Lakin. As you heard in this interview, she edited Kermit Zarley's book, and I'm having him on this podcast next week. So stay tuned for an interesting interview with the PGA pro golfer, Kermit Zarley, turned scholar, turned biblical Unitarian Christian activist, and author and evangelist. Stay tuned for him next week. But anyhow, just wanted to make a couple comments on these comments that have come in. First of all, I left out websites in my helpful tools survey last week. Was that on purpose? Well, I think to one degree, websites come and they go. And the other resources, I think, are a little more stable. In another sense, I guess I'm just sort of biased in favor of Bible software. I have been a BibleWorks guy forever. When they went out of business, it was very sad. But then I was able to make the transition to Accordance, which very much feels like BibleWorks. Doesn't actually run as well, which is sad. But anyhow, that's a subject for another day. BibleWorks, Accordance, Logos, that's where I'm at. I honestly never have a reason to go to one of these websites where they offer freebie translations. So I'm a little bit ignorant on what they even are, but I'm thankful that Susanna Kermit both commented in that Blue Letter Bible is the place to go. I'll have to check it out sometime. Sounds like a place where you can get a lot of different Bible verses. I know Bible Gateway is another one that people use, and there is one called Hub or something like that. Hey, whatever works for you is just fine with me. The idea is to get access to the translations. I also ended up buying a lot of hardcover translations for the Bible because a lot of times they don't license, especially the Jewish translations. Like, I don't think Robert Alter is available on Accordance. I think Logos still doesn't have Shocken. I'm not sure about that. And there are a couple of other Jewish translations that I have only in hardcover. Some of the more unique translations like N.T. Wright's and John Goldengay went in together on the Bible for Everyone translation. Some other ones that I have, just looking at my shelf, done by individuals are not available in the Bible software or on those websites. So I think there is definitely a place for having physical Bibles still as well when you are looking to compare on specific verses. So thanks for sharing about Blue Letter Bible on Ziad's comment and Kermit about the Net Bible notes. I strongly agree with them. I have been a Net Bible fan since the early 2000s, have always loved the philosophy and approach of the NET Bible, and have enjoyed, I can't say that I've read all 60,000 of the footnotes, but I have certainly enjoyed many of the footnotes. I found them unusually honest, especially for an evangelical committee where people are absolutely convinced that they have to believe what the Bible says. And so that creates a pressure, as Jason David Badoon remarked in his book, Truth in Translation, that creates a pressure, what he calls the Protestant burden, to make the Bible say the sorts of things that they know it's supposed to be teaching based on their evangelical assumptions and dogma. Whereas other camps are less burdened to have the Bible say what they want it to say. Anyhow, I think the NET is a really good example of evangelical scholarship courageously speaking truth as much as they possibly can. Of course, presuppositions are invisible to us most of the time, so I'm not trying to ascribe malice to anybody who doesn't do that, but I do think the NET is really exceptional. A lot of their comments are really helpful. And they do give multiple options instead of just saying the way they think it is, which I think is super great too. So yeah, you should go out and buy a Net Bible. Come on. If you're gonna be serious about Bible study and you want a Bible that's gonna have lots of footnotes to tell you what's going on with the manuscripts, tell you what's going on with the translation options, tell you what's going on with the context, at least to some degree, the historical context, the Net Bible is really a good choice. And it's free at netbible.org if you'd rather have the website. I cannot comment on the Constable notes. If anybody else knows about that Bible and those notes from Plano Bible Chapel that Ziad had posted, I'm not familiar with it, so sorry I can't comment. If any of you are, come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 551, Helpful Tools to Understand the Bible. Leave your comment there or on the Facebook group if you prefer. and would love to hear more engagement on this very important question. Look, your tools are going to define you. And I think I made pretty clear in that episode last week that if you're using all free but out of copyright 1800s or 1700s resources, guess what? They have significant limitations on what scholarship was available, what discoveries were made, and they tend to be way more biased and invisible and unaware of their bias, which is problematic. I think modern commentaries and research tools are better for you. I mentioned last time the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary. I use this commentary, I don't want to say every day, but like all the time. I've heard Tim Mackey endorse it multiple times on his Bible Project podcast. John Walton was involved with the making of this, at least the Old Testament side of it. So, I mean, these are some really great names endorsing this, and I have certainly found that it is very helpful. So I would definitely suggest, especially if you have Bible software, to get the digital version of that. Paper version is probably even better because of the glossy pictures. And I know I'm sounding like a commercial here. I promise you I'm not getting paid by any of these people. I just want you to have good resources because good Bible tools are going to help you engage and understand the scripture better. And bad tools are going to get you stuck in corners that you don't need to be stuck in, where there are answers and there are solutions and there is helpful comparable information to get you thinking in a way that they were thinking at that time, which is really the great key to interpretation that many of us miss out on. So take a look at all that. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. If you'd like to support Restitutio, you can do that at our website, restitutio.org. Catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.